Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners may find disturbing.
If you're still listening, in the words of Bridget Jones, bugger off!
Hi guys, so I'm going to be telling my story first. This is Lucy, and it's not my murder. Like, I'm not.
I'm going to tell my personal story.
So I'm going to tell you about the murder of Kirsty Grabham. So Kirsty Wilkinson was born in 1984, and she had two older sisters, and she was very close to her mother. Now, when she was 14, the family moved to Bridgend in Wales, and not the best.
Obviously, you are quite good at a Welsh accent because of family. But wasn't there a while ago you said something awkward about Welsh people? What was it? Your Welsh stereotype? I'm sure you said it on the podcast. Like, Welsh people are something.
Inbred.
I don't think that's what you said, but fair enough. We'll take it.
Do you remember when everyone used to say Welsh people were sheep shaggers?
Yeah, but they also say that about people in Derby, people in Norfolk.
Yeah, Bristol.
What it makes me think is that everyone wants to shag sheep and they're just projecting it onto nearby towns.
That's very Freudian of you.
Thanks.
So they moved to Wales and Kirsty very much idolised the supermodel Jordan, which I think when I was growing up, she was...
The artist formerly known as Jordan.
Yeah, Katie Price now, isn't she? Yeah. But she was very much in the media.
Yeah, because she dated Gareth Gates. And at the time, everyone was like, is that abuse?
Yeah.
It definitely seemed like some sort of child abuse was happening.
And then she married Peter Andre, and then they broke up. But I feel like when I was like young teenager, she was like the supermodel that people knew with a massive beard.
When she first came out, no one was taking the piss out of her. Everyone was like, she's the ultimate woman.
Yeah, and then like, what was it? Jodie Marsh came out like,
then she's like, she was like, I'm the real girl, my tits are real.
She was like the Trumpy Jordan. We were like, we didn't know that was gonna be a thing, but she managed it. Like, yeah. Oh my god. If you don't know who these people are, if you're in another culture, have a look at Jordan and have a look at Jodie Marsh and tell us what you think. But fair play to them. They've had very lucrative careers. She wanted to follow in Jordan's footsteps. So she was very naturally pretty, and she did kind of like this supermodel glam look as well. And very much noticed by men, and she kind of knew that she'd probably do quite well. So at age 20, she spent her teenage years kind of trying to move into the world of glamour model. Age 23, she meets Paul Grabham at a party, and they have a one-night stand. But there's a different account. One account was that she met him earlier, and then at the one night stand they realized that they'd already met before, and then the other one was that they had a one night stand but then they met again later. I'm not sure which is the case, but this second time they met, they were absolutely infatuated with each other and very, very quickly inseparable. Now, he'd not been a very good student at school. He got in trouble a lot. He'd been a bit of a strange boy. With his friends, on the documentary that I watched, which was on YouTube, which is called The Murder of Kirsty Grabham, he had this neighbour who was talking about how him and his friends had been out on the road, and they basically chased her car in their car.
Like that exactly like that scene from The Inbetweeners where they're like, follow the muff wagon. And they're just like, what's the best case scenario that's going to happen here? You chase after them and then what?
Yeah.
But we've all done it, like a little bit of motorway flirting.
Well, she wasn't a looker. I'm not sure if like times had changed.
Yeah, but it depends where you're driving from. All you can see is like, you look at the profile, back of the head, you're like,
there's a woman in that car.
Yeah, pretty much.
Go!
Chase it down!
Chase it. So she ended up driving into a brick wall and she was really freaked out. And
oh
she
God,
actually,
that's actually quite bad.
She actually moved out of the area and she just did not like this guy.
Well, it is a bad thing to do, chase a woman down with your car, because
they're
either going to crash into a brick wall or drive away faster than you can, in which you've wasted a lot of petrol.
True.
Or, I don't know, ram you to make it stop. I don't see how it could end well. Just park up at traffic lights and both be like, look, fuck the traffic. Let's swap numbers now.
Kirsty's family didn't see what she saw in Paul. So obviously they met. They were really serious really quickly. And so they met him. He was a chef. Which
helps.
Which, yeah. And a plumber. So, I mean, I can see the uses here.
Yeah.
But he also had like really weird little other jobs. He always looked really scruffy. And he also worked as a male stripper. Yeah, he's either going to be really good at all these three things or really terrible, like spreading himself too thin.
Jack of all trades.
And he'd also be really braggy. He'd like make up things about how much money he had to impress others. And they just weren't impressed with him. They thought he was awful.
Oh, so it sounds like he is shit at all the jobs then.
I think so. And he like had that like blonde highlights and like the tan and like just super fake looking.
Those little beaded necklaces.
Yes. So then they tried. So Kirsty says she's going to marry him. And they try and put her off. They say, wait. But she wants like the big dramatic wedding. I think Jordan had like the horse and car.
Yeah, she had the Cinderella pumpkin carriage.
Yeah. And this is what Kirsty wanted. She just wanted to be having this beautiful wedding. So after 5 weeks, after they began dating, they actually got engaged.
5 weeks?
5 weeks. And then they got married. She had like the pink limo, the tiara, and like there's wedding videos on this documentary. And he like didn't even have a tie on. His shirt's like open at the top. He looks like a naughty boy on the way home from school. Like just not cute. Baggy shirt. Doesn't really fit him properly.
So he looked like a year 11 prom then.
Yeah. So quickly into the marriage, Paul began to become quite controlling of her. So he had access to her money and he begins to introduce drugs to the household. And she kept a diary and she kept quite a good log, actually, of all the things that he was doing. She's pretty honest in this diary. At first, when she meets him, she writes about how it's her and Paul against the world. But she does start to kind of right in there about, you know, I wish he wouldn't control me. I wish he wouldn't make me do the things that he's making me do. And both of the couple were working in the sex industry as escorts. So she was, I think she was actually working at a brothel and he was advertising himself online. But she was also, I think they had a website where they advertised themselves online as well, together or apart. I mean, imagine being the third wheel in a husband-wife sexathon.
No,
it's not like
you
bickering over the dishes halfway through.
No,
got paid for this. So she didn't like working at this brothel, and that's actually apparent. Like some sources say that she met Paul at the brothel earlier, and he'd hired her, and then they had this one night stand later on. So she didn't tell her family she was working at a brothel. She told them that she was a glamour model, but she was having sex with other people. And she kind of liked that he accepted that because she thought there's not many men who were going to be on board for this lifestyle. And she wanted to go more into like glamour modeling, but she was saving money. But
that's the sort of thing that keeps people though, isn't it? I know it's like saying, I don't know, like he accepts my lifestyle, but it's a little bit of low self-esteem. Like who else would want, who else would take me on? And that's how they keep you, because they say no one else would have you. Like, what are you going to do without me?
Absolutely. And she didn't really want to be doing it. So she She thought he was a way out when she married him. She thought, this is my way out of this lifestyle. He accepts me, but he helped me move away from this. But actually, he was pressuring her to work a lot more so he could get the money and spend the money, and he had access to her bank accounts. So, I mean, this is an abusive relationship. Yeah. He is very much controlling her, abusing her. So she writes about this in her diaries, questioning, like, why does he actually want me to have sex with other men? Wouldn't he, you know, want me to just be his? And she wanted to stop, and she wanted to have a child. So just months after they were married, Kirsty tells her sister that Paul started to be violent towards her. And they talked to a psychologist, actually, on this documentary. And this psychologist said that it's very unlikely that she spoke out the first time he was violent. It's probably that this was just the first time she was actually that scared enough to tell someone, because she was in fear of her life. So probably there was some small violence up until this point. But at this point, he'd actually choked her, and she thought she was going to die. So I think that's when she got to the point where she thought, I've got to tell someone. Yeah. Have you watched Big Little Lies?
No, I haven't.
It's really good, and it's really well portrayed domestic violence.
Oh, I did not think you were going there.
No, there's a lot of domestic violence in it. And Nicole Kidman is the woman who's in a violent relationship, and she does it really well, and it does really show kind of the complexities of the relationship, the idea that she thinks it's okay if it's not affecting the children. But also there's an interesting psychologist character in there who is really blunt about it, and I just liked this character. And she was like, you've got to tell your friends, because if it comes to court and they say, why didn't you tell anyone, they'll start saying that it's never happened to you. You've got to speak out about it. And I've never thought about it like that before. And I think it's good that she told her sister, because then you've got someone else to say, I knew it was violent, someone told me.
Yeah, or at least to give some sort of time frame as how long it's been happening. Is that
yeah.
what you mean?
Yeah, like a witness on your side. Yeah. So, and she also wrote about it in the diary. So
happy people don't keep diaries, do they?
No.
I'm sure that's a line from Adrian Mole, but it is true.
Oh, yeah, I never thought of that. Like, my life was wonderful today.
Like, name, like, Anne Frank? Nope. Who else is a famous diarist? Samuel Pepys? He was too much of a nerd. Nope.
No, I've not read Pepys.
Diary of a Nobody? Nope, he wasn't happy.
So Kirsty's sister tells their mother, and the mother pleads with her to leave him, but I think she sort of does, and then it's off and on again. Another thing that they thought was weird was Paul had this weird collection of dolls as well that he kept in the loft, and it was like these... They're like adult dolls.
Sex dolls?
They're not like adult life-size sex dolls, but they're like little plastic figures.
Or like Funko Pops.
Like little dolls in like coffins, and they're like look all gothic.
Oh, shit. Like, I know the ones.
And there's one that's like being strangled, and one with a gun, and like...
Yes! Wait, aren't they called like dead dolls?
Yeah, that kind of thing. Which is funny, because Luke's sister, who's got learning difficulties, she bought her nephew one of these dolls. It's like a really scary Chucky doll, but I think she just thought she was buying him a nice doll, and it really scared the shit out of him for ages. So awkward. We're like, shall we take this away now? So anyway, Kirsty asked Paul to stop with the violence, the drugs, and she said, I want to start a family. You need to, you know, clear your life out. We need to get back to where we should be on track. But to family, she says, I'm thinking of ending the relationship. And he was giving her sort of rules as well about her sexual encounters as part of her job. And he wouldn't follow the same rules. He was meeting up with women outside of like the time that he was being hired by them. And she saw that as cheating as well. So it's just getting more and more dangerous, high risk. And just, she was really sad. She knew it was shit. Like, she knew it wasn't going to go well for her. So she makes plans to go to stay with her cousin in Coventry to get away. But she suddenly goes back on these, and she stays with Grabham. But days later, they go out for drinks and have a row. And then Grabham goes home, and then she goes back home later. And the taxi driver is just the last person to see her at this point.
It's always the taxi driver who's the last person to see you alive. Just like that episode of Sherlock where it was the taxi driver who was killing people.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So on the Sunday, Grabham calls Kirsty's friend, Martin, who's like a proper Welsh bloke. Like, he's He's got a great accent. He's a bit like a bit older. You know, like if he talks too fast, you can't really follow what he's saying. And he says, me and Kirsty were arguing, and she's gone. She's taken her clothes. She's moved out. I don't know where she's gone. Have you seen her? And he says, no. He phones Kirsty. And then Grabham phones Kirsty's mum as well. She says, have you seen Kirsty? And she's really suspicious. And she tells him to phone the police, which he does. And she also phones the police. And she tells them about this violence because she is having none of it. So Kirsty's sister is also suspicious because she goes round to the house. And she's taken like cash with her. But Kirsty's bank card's there and like her hairbrush. And she just says, there's just no way. There's no way that she would have gone without taking these certain things. I know Kirsty. And Grabham's also reading the text on Kirsty's phone. And the family think that she's taken the phone with her. So they're texting her. He's reading everything. He doesn't reply. He doesn't fake any responses. But they just think she's not responding. So despite Grabham's phoning round saying he's concerned, he continues to have these wild parties at his house, like just in the days after Kirsty's disappeared. So he takes drugs. He's using Kirsty's car to pay for sex workers to come round and have sex with him. He drives her car to visit
That's
women.
That's such a weird thing, do you not think, for a sex worker to pay a sex worker?
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know. Or is it the ideal thing? Because it's like, I understand how your time is valuable. I'd have thought you'd have a lot of sex worker mates and you'd just be like,
what, fancy a freebie?
Off the clock.
I'm not sure how it works. So he drives her...
There's only one way to find out.
What, become a sex worker?
Both become sex workers.
So he drives a car to visit women that he'd been speaking to on the internet. And one of the women he contacts is the daughter of the neighbour that he ran off the road all those years ago because she stayed in the area. So then, like, this neighbour's like, I can't believe he contacted my daughter. I hate this bastard. But luckily, the daughter just ignores his messages. But he's, like, sort of hitting her up. I think he'd been, maybe been at
what
school with her
the
or
hell?
Something. Because the neighbour's a bit older.
That's like, that's really reaching.
Yeah, yeah. He was just like, oh, hey, oh, I'm like, single know, now.
Like, yeah, like you go back. We've all done it, like the drunk to the last person you slept with, sending them a little
text.
Well,
he was sending it to every person in the community.
Back, don't go back 10 years to some woman that you saw on the road one time.
I know, right.
That is desperate. That's got to be the definition of desperation.
Yeah.
Like, how desperate were you? Well, I rang up a woman I once ran off the road. Crazy.
So South Wales police investigate Kirsty's disappearance, and Kirsty's friend Martin, he goes round to the house and he notices the rug is missing out of the living room and part of the ceiling has been repainted. And he's like, why did you repaint part of the ceiling, Grabham? And he says that he started repainting it, but Kirsty made him stop because she didn't like the colour. And he's like, oh, okay then. And then
so it wasn't like just a freshly painted piece, like a, oh, it looks slightly cleaner. It was literally a different colour.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, literally like maybe like purple. I don't
They'll
know.
They'll never know something's gone on here.
So he goes to the police and tells them that part of the ceiling's been repainted. So the police...
There is a crime against interior design.
Yeah. And also, Grabham's story doesn't hold up because they check the records and they find that Kirsty had tried to call 999 on the night she disappeared. So if she was running away, why would she phone 999? Yeah. She was clearly... there was a struggle. She was trying to get away. So they arrest Grabham and he says no comment to everything, infuriatingly. So 8 days after she disappeared, Kirsty's body is found. And it's in a really small suitcase that had literally just been flung by the motorway. Just thrown off like... a bridge or into like the woods, and some lorry driver had been going past and looked in it, which
ooh,
I found
free suitcase.
Yeah, I found that really weird. It's like, oh, there's a weird old suitcase over there. I must take a little peek. I must stop my lorry and see what's inside. It's probably dog in, wasn't it?
Or he was on his way to the Antiques Roadshow and thought, ooh, what a find.
So she was inside. She'd been battered, squashed into the suitcase, scratched, and her jaw was broken. So clearly had been violently beaten. So in Kirsty's diary, she'd written 10 things that she wanted at her funeral. And she was 24 years old. So she knew this was going to end badly.
That's horrendous that she's thinking about her own mortality. So
So they followed all these things at her funeral because she'd sort of planned it then. And one of the things that she wanted her wedding and engagement ring to be removed when she was buried.
Well, that's damning, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So at trial, evidence against Grabham piled up: her diary, his changing story, the alcohol, the drug use. And after Kirsty had returned from the night out, he'd hit her with a heavy object and beaten her. And neighbours had heard screaming. As if someone was being strangled, which, why didn't they call the police?
I was going to say, you'd think that would have come up sooner.
I think they were arguing a lot, and I think they just kind of didn't get involved.
They're at it again.
Yeah. He then put her in a suitcase, at one point trying to cut her in half. There was a mark across her body, but decided against it. And then he dragged it down the stairs, put it in her car in the boot, and driven away and chucked it off the motorway. Blood was found in the mop and bucket as well. So he just, it was clearly Grabham. His defence was that he'd been asleep.
I was sleepwalking, basically.
No, he'd been in the house. Someone else had killed her, but he'd been asleep when she'd been murdered.
That's a good
one.
Like,
on the sofa. So, I mean, bullshit. So he's found guilty by all the jury, received a life sentence with a minimum of 19 years. But tragically, Kirsty's sister Hayley, so he's still in prison, but Kirsty's sister has really struggled to cope with the murder of Kirsty, and she actually, 5 years later, she was drinking so excessively that she died of alcoholism. So their mother's lost 2 children.
That's really sad.
And she blames poor Grabham for the death of both. So really sad story. If you're obviously in a violent relationship, do speak out, do get help. It's so, so important that you act now.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Right, moving swiftly on, we're going to the tale of Stephen Griffiths. Now, this is quite a modern one for me.
Oh.
We're actually going to be going right up to the 2010s. So it's a little bit of a departure from my usual form, I would say. And I'm a little bit nervous about it because obviously it's hard. Like, when they're modern, there's so much more. There's so much to wade through. So much is available to you. Because, like, really random people are still able to come and speak up. Like, random school friends, neighbours. Like, everyone can put their opinion out into the world.
I was typing the name of the murderer and then Reddit. Because that's usually a bit of a gold mine. Because they'd be like, I used to go to school with. That's always a good one.
Yeah. So I've done my best for you. But this is one that's quite interesting and worth a little look around in your own time later.
Homework.
So Stephen Griffiths, he was born on the 24th of December in 1969. But his parents split up quite soon after he was born. And he lived with his mother, though his father was still kind of in his life and was supporting him. His parents were able to give him quite a good start in life, and they actually saved up and paid to his yearly fees so that they could send him to a private school. And he went there when he was 13. So he's not particularly from a privileged background. Him and his mum and his siblings, they lived on a council estate in Wakefield. But he was really intelligent. And I think his family were like, we've got to do something with him because he's so bright.
It's going to be the teacup poisoner, isn't it?
Something similar.
No.
They just thought he was so bright. They were like, we need to help him realise his potential. So they really, really scrimped and saved to send to this quite prestigious grammar school. A neighbour who lived on the estate when Griffiths was a child was quoted by the BBC as saying that, quote, he didn't play out and you only saw him at night.
Oh.
Which is a weird thing to say about a child.
About a small child, absolutely.
Yeah. And then they went on to say that he would, when he was out at night, he'd shoot birds with his air gun.
Fucking hell.
And then he would really enjoy dissecting them by like ripping them apart.
Oh,
really gross.
Yeah, so, that's not normal. Although
it's not normal,
but it's not completely abnormal either. Like boys look like slicing open, maybe like more dead animals, I guess.
Yeah, but it is one of the signs that we're getting to a
psychopath. Yeah.
Yes. So a fellow pupil at the grammar school he attended, he said that Stephen Griffiths was just really quiet. He actually described it as being insignificant.
Ooh. Like,
no one...
Not a school report.
That's really harsh, isn't it? But he was
no
just
one went
like,
to collect his school report. Yeah. Is that insignificant?
I think it's because, you know, he was a little bit, I think there's some snobbery going on because of where he was from. But also, he didn't want to interact with people. He wanted to keep himself to himself. He was never going to be one of the cool kids. He was little and nerdy. And he just preferred to lose himself in fantasy, role-playing games, things like Dungeons and Dragons. He also developed a keen interest in weaponry, owning like swords, knives, and he's even said to have brought throwing stars to school on occasion.
That's not that insignificant.
Yeah.
You'd think that'd at least get you a nickname.
Yeah, you'd think so. I think he's one of, like, I'm sure we've got listeners who are into this sort of stuff too. And I think as teenagers, we were probably friends with a lot of people that were into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
He's 100%. Like a kind of just alternative kid, yeah. But definitely quiet as well. Mm. But he did take this further, his interest in things that were like the weapons and stuff, and he got involved in criminal behaviors when he was a teenager. He started shoplifting, and then at 17 he was caught in the act by a supermarket worker. So Griffith took out a knife he was carrying and slashed the shop worker across the throat.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I think like also shoplifting, was he shoplifting on his own as far as you know?
Yeah, I think so.
Because that's usually, for teenagers, that's usually like a group thing, isn't it?
Exactly. So again, it's more the psychopathic behaviors we're seeing. So for this attack, he was given 3 years in a reform institution.
Yeah.
And he was in regular counseling sessions, and it was here that he explained that he wanted to be a known serial killer. He said he also talked about the fact that he had insects crawling in his brain, and that in order to sleep at night, he'd have to put cotton wool in his ears to prevent more insects from getting in. And he could hear them in there. And this was something that girlfriends later would say that he still did as an adult. And if he hadn't brought his cotton wool to like his girlfriend's house, he'd have to stay up all night. Like, so this was a very clear indicator that he's actually suffering from psychosis.
Yeah.
He's hearing things and seeing things. But his assessment at the end of his sentence deemed that he wasn't a threat to society, and he was released.
Even though he said he wanted to be a known serial killer. Yeah.
I think a lot of it was put down to he's a weird teenager.
Yeah.
And I think that covered it up as a child anyway.
I think though, 10, 15 years ago, we were a bit more, we're teenagers. But now with stuff like Sword and Scale and kids like shooting their family in the face, I think maybe we do take stuff a bit more seriously.
Yeah.
Because we're like, yeah, but they're never going to actually murder someone, are they?
Yeah. And at this point, it was sort of in the, this would have been in the late 70s, early 80s. And we were starting to get some of these really big serial killers coming out, particularly in America. But
they were like grown adults, weren't they?
It was filtering through to over here, I think.
Yeah.
So a year after his release in 1990, Griffiths was arrested again. This time he'd been in a college library, and he was like, he always had like really long, when he was younger, he had long black curly hair slicked back. He wore long Matrix leather coats.
Oh God, one of those.
Sunglasses. Like he was definitely alternative. Quiet, and like I imagine that he slouched when he walked.
I can see him now.
Yeah. So he was in this college library, and there was like a group of the popular cute girls over on a table having giggling as they tend to do, and he like went mad. He was like, they're talking about me, what the fuck are you saying?
Oh shit.
So again, got out his knife and threatened one of the girls with it, threatening to stab her because he thought they were making fun of him. He then, one the girls went off and she told her dad. Her dad confronted him and he threatened him with the knife.
Whoa!
Too. So yeah, he was given 2-year sentence in prison for that because he didn't actually do anything.
It's like a film I watched last night, and Luke, literally, I turn it on, 5 minutes in, Luke's out like a light. And I was like, I guess I'm watching this film on my own. And I can't remember what it was called, but it was so shit. It was basically, like these girls were like on their phones, like, oh my God, social media. And then the premise of the film is social media makes people crazy because they just wanted to like murder each other a lot. But they were all rich, annoying bitches, and I wanted them all to die the whole time. And then, of course, it was a film. And then I looked at loads of reviews, and everyone was like, yeah, the audience really wants the children to die because they're so annoying bitches. I have to look at the name of it. It was so terrible.
I mean, that is bad if you're just wanting kids dead.
Because they're pure nasty to each other. So horrid. They're like, you're a fat pig to this one girl. Why don't you just kill yourself? Oh. I was like, oh, these girls are...
Well, like, if someone's got to die, well, it should be yeah. there. So, yeah, so for this threatening, he was given a 2-year sentence in actual prison. But while he was in prison, he started studying... I think you're going to find a lot of parallels with yourself.
Oh, this. Shit.
He started studying for a psychology degree.
And then dropped out.
And
because that's what I did.
He was particularly interested in the psychology of infamous killers. Like he
What every kid now wants to study.
In particular, he became really in awe of the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe. And he just devoured books on the subject. He just loved all of them, like pretty much how a lot of true crime fans start. He was there. He was there for Dahmer. He was there for Albert Fish, and he was there for but Peter Sutcliffe was a bit of a local hero for him.
Yeah.
And he just was obsessed with them. He was diagnosed around this sort of time with, well, this again, there's lots of different accounts. One place got his diagnosis as psychopathic schizoid obsessive.
Sounds like a load of like,
yeah,
he's a weirdo word pushed together, like, again. Yeah.
But he definitely was prescribed medication, but it's thought that he never really got into taking it, wasn't down for that. So 1996 was a big year for Griffiths. He was released. He enrolled on a PhD course at Bradford University, where he was going to devote himself fully to working on his passion, which was a thesis about murder in an industrialized city. He was looking at comparing historic murders to modern murders and just researching murders all of the time. That's all he wanted to do. And he also moved into a flat in a converted mill called Homefield Court, which was an area well frequented by sex workers and an area where Peter Sutcliffe was definitely known to have been around in Bradford. So I think he'd chosen that on purpose. He wanted to be someone who was on par with his hero, Peter Sutcliffe, and he was starting to sort of follow in his footsteps.
Yeah.
So for the first few years, it seems that Griffiths had no interest in the sex workers, particularly for himself. He was definitely considered rather odd. As I said, he dressed in that way the whole time, like he was in the Matrix. And he also was known for like local people as the lizard guy. Because he had pets.
Because he had a lizard.
He had a couple of pet lizards, but he would go out walking them with like little harnesses and leads.
Yeah, that would draw attention to you, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and he didn't speak to people. They just often, so they'd just be like, "Oh, there he is again with his lizards taking him for a walk." But he did actually go out and make friends at university and stuff. And there are documentaries where there's interviews with people who met him out in the clubs and went to university with him and sort of knew him. And he did also have long-term relationships in this period in the 90s. So one of his girlfriends was called Zita Pinder. And she said that she dated him for 2 years, but all the time she thought that he was living with his parents.
So she never went around. I guess she wouldn't if he lives with his parents.
Yeah, she just, I just think she, I don't think they could have been that serious for 2 years, because she just sort of never, eventually it came up anyway.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a huge argument. It was just like, oh shit, yeah, I'll come see it. So he took her round, and when she was there, she was said that his living room was absolutely frightening. There was, so it was like a maze, of like, as she describes it, with tanks and books and things. So there was tanks for various lizards. Then there were huge amounts of rats, I think dead. I think dead, that he would use to feed the lizards.
I bet they were live then, because like live food's a thing, isn't it?
I think he just kept, I think it doesn't say specifically, so I thought they would be alive. And then he had loads and loads of bookshelves and books piled up everywhere, all true crime books.
Yeah.
Like, which of course we do have.
I know, yeah. Like, oh, that's fine.
Yeah, that sounds quite normal. Like, So already I'm looking around my living room and being like, okay, hamster cage, lots of things, big bookshelves with true crime.
There's a rat that lives in my garden.
I had a rat in my house once, like, similarities. He also did, had, again, which a lot of people, we know this guy, I think I dated him at one point, where when I was like 13. He reminds me of Johnny.
My God, Johnny.
He had samurai swords and like other replica swords. He had axes. He had a crossbow. And they're just like laid around his living room. Like everything's just out on display. Oh. And then, but the weird bit though, that makes it very much more psychopathy, is that everything was covered in plastic.
Oh God.
Like the sofa's covered in plastic.
Oh no. Like they used to keep like the good sofa in the little plastic wrap. Yeah, there's no excuse for that.
And on his wall, he had like pictures and cuttings and stuff of the serial killers that he liked best. It was basically just a shrine to true crime. And again, that was his thesis. So there was nothing like these, like looking back
now.
Yeah,
it's not like there's like a severed head in the fridge. You're like, oh, yeah, it's weird, but.
I mean, like looking back now, you can be like, oh my God, you should have known that he was crazy. These are obvious red flags. But lots of people are into this stuff. Yeah. And it just, that's how it stays, just like a weird morbid curiosity.
I imagine like if she's dating this guy who wears long leather coats and has got really long hair, she's probably a bit alternative herself.
Yeah, right. But that was too much for her, the living room, when she saw his flat. So she just said that she was feeling ill, actually, I need to leave. So she got out of there and then called him up the next day and just ended it.
Oh, did she? Oh.
It was way too much for like her. And I think it was the fact that he hid in it as well.
Yeah.
And then revealed this house where everything was just dedicated to murder.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
But up until that point, she'd said that really the only thing that was weird was that when they would watch horror films, which was most of the time, see, it is very you, when they're watching horror films, that he would laugh at all the worst bits.
Yeah, no, I don't laugh. I've got my head behind my hands.
Yeah, that's all they said, that just...
Yeah, that's... Everything. Yeah. That is strange.
Other girlfriends had a very different experience with him, though. There was a girl called Kathy Hancock, and she dated Griffiths. And she described him as being extremely abusive. She said that he would be really quiet and introverted, and then he would just flip and he would hit her. He had stabbed her. And one time, Kathy was hospitalized because he'd poisoned her tea.
Shit.
So she was only alerted to the fact that something was wrong because Griffiths was just uncontrollably laughing in her face.
Oh my God.
And she was like, what is wrong with you? Why are you laughing? And
I'm just enjoying this lovely cup of tea.
Exactly. And he just was laughing. And she demanded to know, why are you not going to stop laughing? And he just said to her, because you're dying.
fuck.
Like, he's...
That's next level.
He's the worst.
He's the worst. I mean,
they eventually split up, and there's another huge long history of even up to the time when he was eventually captured, where he was still obsessed with Kathy and would, like, intermittently, like,
but I'm sure
ring her up and, like, leave messages where he's just laughing down the phone at
fuck. Her. But the Yorkshire Ripper, didn't he famously... He had a wife who had no idea, didn't he? Like, he was never abusive. There's a lot of like serial killers and murderers who have, like, their wife has no idea. Like, they've got a normal relationship. They're not abusive in any way. But he was violent towards sex workers. Whereas this guy just seems to be taking, like, the fact he's in a relationship as an opportunity to, like, inflict violence on someone else. Yeah.
Well, I think his illness definitely made him go through periods, and it wasn't until later that, I mean, he was always really liked Peter Sutcliffe, but he loved, it sounds weird to say, but he liked a lot of serial killers as well. So it was only later when he really became like, this is what I'm gonna do.
Yeah.
So he split with her, and then he started to become more and more isolated from society and other people. He began to take drugs, and the friends that he had at uni ended up all breaking ties with him. They would have huge arguments. He was changing, basically.
Yeah.
Possibly not taking his medication and various things, but he was definitely on drugs. I mean, one of his friends that he knew when he was at uni was like, he was on stuff to get him up in the morning, he'd be taking drugs to help him sleep at night. He was just all over the place. So it was in 2001 when Stephen Griffiths began to socialize almost exclusively with the sex workers who worked on the street outside of his flat. They described him as being like a big brother figure. So sometimes he would sleep with them. Sometimes he would just have people over and they'd take drugs together. Or he'd like off to share drugs with them. He might give someone a bed for the night. He would loan girls money if they needed them. He was generally just like,
like
a friend to them, pretty much. Like they said, a big brother.
Yeah.
But he was getting to know them.
Yeah, he's taking opportunities.
So he also spent a lot of time online, as you can imagine, at this period in his life.
Oh, yeah, because he's like internet. I'm used to your stories being like, they were in the horse and cart.
Yeah. So he spent a lot of time, because obviously his job is to just do his PhD research, and he's online almost all the time, and he spent a lot of time curating his MySpace page. And he posted under the name Then Pariah. I don't know why. So I mean, obviously Pariah is an outcast, and that's how he saw himself, as different from society. And like I said, again, definitely when the things that were on his profile seem like he's obviously a crazed person, but they're just like things that you're into. His favorite film was Clockwork Orange.
I like Clockwork Orange.
All listed on, these are just various things listed on his profiles. One of his favorite bands was Nirvana.
I loved Nirvana.
He would post short biographies of different serial killers and post pictures of them, basically
know about
what we do
killers.
Here. He did have the weirder, there were weirder parts. Like, he posted a picture of one of his crossbows with the caption, crossbow is family.
Yeah, that's, yeah,
definitely weirder. And then he had like shirt. He was quite vain as well. He had like topless pictures and headshots. And he posted quotes from Reservoir Dogs, that the Ezekiel quote from that film. Oh, no, from Pulp Fiction, I think.
Yeah.
And then I'm just going to read you his bio that he had on there.
I remember the name of that weird film I watched last night. I should have known. I did know when I started watching it. It's called Hashtag Horror.
Oh, okay. It's you your own fault. Yeah. So in his MySpace profile, he said, oh, he's got a really soft, like, Yorkshire. It sounds just like my uncle. I'm just trying to think, physically, I take care of my body and face, especially the latter, which he was like really dark and serious, but his voice in interviews when you hear him, he's just like, oh, I don't know. I just sort of killed them. So physically, I take care of my body and face, especially the latter, which refuses to look any older than a 25-year-old's. Maybe I have a Dorian Gray portrait hidden away. My occupation involves homicide research, which demands a lot of discipline and emotional detachment. Hardly laugh-a-minute work either. Hence, it's important for me to relax slash unwind at other times. Although I'm an extremely tough, assertive individual, I'm not the overbearing type.
I mean, he sounds quite insightful about himself a little bit. I mean, I wouldn't read it. I probably wouldn't check back.
Yeah.
But it's not like he's just, like, caps lock, everybody needs to die.
No. He was just like, he just loved himself. Yeah. And he was just like, he was just researching everything. He knew, he had said when he was younger that he wanted to be an infamous killer, and that's what he wanted to be known for. And I think it seems, and other people have suggested, that he was researching his PhD to use.
Yeah, like, oh, if I'm so gonna research,
he wasn't ready
this,
yet. Yeah. Basically, he was gonna do it. He wasn't just gonna be like, get caught now.
He wanted to be an academic killer.
Exactly. So in 2009, the staff at Homefield Court were very wary of Griffiths by this point. They'd had a panic button installed in the office after he'd made threats, and the caretaker had been instructed not to challenge Griffiths over anything because they just perceived him to be really potentially violent. They weren't interested. So around this time then, June 22nd of 2009, was when the first woman disappeared. She was 43-year-old mother of two called Susan Rushworth, and she'd been from a loving family, and it was only when she became involved in drugs that her life began to spiral. So according to her brother, he says that she'd started smoking weed, and then it had gone from there till eventually she was addicted to heroin.
I'd thought weed was not a gateway drug.
Well, that's why I said according to her brother, because he said in an interview, he said she started smoking weed and then she wanted a bigger high, so she went on to this, which is what they used to tell you back in the day. Yeah. So it could be the case. So she was eventually addicted to heroin, though, and she began selling herself on the streets of Bradford to make money for her habit. But after this date in June, she was never seen again. On April 26th of 2010, a second woman called Shelley Armitage had also been reported missing. She'd turned to sex work to fund a heroin addiction also, and her boyfriend contacted the police when she hadn't been seen for 2 days. And then not long after this, on May 22nd, 2010, a third woman vanished with a very similar profile. Suzanne Blumiers, she'd been training to be a nurse and once again had just got caught, because she has had quite a bright future, but had just got caught up in drugs and again addicted to heroin that had left her with few options but to turn to sex work. So all of these women are very, very similar. They're the most vulnerable of the vulnerable.
Yeah,
they're not just in sex work as like a chosen profession, they're in sex work because they are feeling trapped because they've got a drug habit, and because of this drug habit, quite possibly they're much more, it's much easier to entice them to come with him because they're just desperate.
They'll take bigger risks. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. He's known to be a bit of a weirdo, but what if you're in withdrawal, like it just feels like
you've got to get that money.
Anyway. So investigations into the disappearance hadn't been too successful, but with the third woman going missing, Suzanne, it was becoming apparent that there was quite possibly a serial killer at work, and a major inquiry took place. But really, it was a breakthrough from Homefield Court that were able to finish this case. So police were contacted by the caretaker at Homefield Court to say that their CCTV cameras had captured a murder. So the footage showed Suzanne Blumiers running out of an apartment down the corridor in the early hours of May 22nd.
Fuck.
She's then pursued by Stephen Griffiths, who tackles her to the ground. He takes up the crossbow he was holding.
Oh my God.
and proceeds to fire a bolt into her head at close range.
Whoa, that's horrible. So he was like she was the prey, like he was hunting her. Fuck.
He then takes her by the legs and just drags her body back into his apartment.
God, that's horrible.
And he knew he was being filmed. I mean, a lot of them say that the cameras were installed because of him. And he knew there were cameras there. He knew he was being filmed. And it appears he didn't care because he then returns into the shot, looks directly into the camera and sticks his middle finger up.
Have you seen the footage?
I've seen like stills. At various points.
It sounds like too much to watch. Like maybe just
don't want to watch the.
I wouldn't mind seeing the screenshot of him in front of the camera.
Yeah.
I don't want to see the murder. That's just too much.
No. So obviously the contact police, they saw this footage. So the police then went to visit Griffiths and he was like quite happy that his time had come. Like you said before, Peter Sutcliffe,
he's gonna fucking love this episode, isn't it?
I know that is a little bit of the thing, is that I'm kind of doing exactly what he wants, but then a lot of people want this too, and I think he's regretting it now.
Yeah,
he's tried to kill himself like a bunch of times.
Okay.
Anyway, police went to visit him and he was loving it. He was joking around. When he answered the door to them, he was like, "Oh, it's me, Osama bin Laden."
What?
Osama bin Laden would just get any kind of joke in the 2010, like
they all
though.
Started like lolling.
I don't think so. But he was, of course, immediately arrested and taken for interview. And police searched his flat and forensics found blood samples of all three missing women. And then inspection of his computer also showed images of Shelley Armitage.
Oh my God.
Tied up in the bath and spray paint on her back that read, "My sex slave."
Oh God. Yeah, that's really psychopathic. He's super
the worst. He's horrible. He's so, so horrible. So in custody, Griffiths confessed to killing all three women. And he also said he'd killed loads of others, but didn't give any details about them. So police did try and link him to others, but nothing mainly. He was completely calm throughout. I mean, he had his like head down and drinking tea, but he was just very, like, no emotion whatsoever. And he was like, "Oh, I'm surprised no one noticed the smoke billowing from my flat when I was burning the evidence." Like, he was just sort of like literally debriefing on the situation. And he told police how after murdering his victims that he'd eaten them. This is like quite widely disputed because, as we know, it's quite difficult to eat people. It doesn't like sit well. And also the fact that he was trying so desperately to be one of the big serial killers,
like trying to get some stuff in there that people might write an article about.
Yeah, because we don't know that he was planning to get caught at the third person, so I think he might have just been like, okay, well, I best say some more things to really cement myself in like the Hall of Horrors. So then some remains of the victims were discovered around the same time that he was arrested. Pieces of flesh and bone were found in a nearby river. Though what was surprising to people at the time was the level of mutilation and dissection. It was so extreme that they actually found around 80 separate pieces, including the mutilated head of Suzanne Blumier, with the crossbow bolt still embedded in her skull.
Fuck.
I mean, that's how they identified her, because they said, because he'd taken off the features.
Oh my God.
Basically. So it seems that Griffiths had dismembered the bodies in such small pieces because he was carrying them out of the flat in his backpack. One neighbour, she recalled seeing him leaving the building one day and was like, "Oh God, there's like a horrid smell around here." And he's just said that he had a dead lizard in his bag that he was getting rid of. So Griffiths went on trial in the December of 2010, and he was not remorseful in the slightest. He enjoyed the attention at first and initially stated his name on the stand as the crossbow cannibal.
Which didn't catch on because it's taken us this long to even cover his story. So
exactly.
There's no way he's one of the most notorious.
No. He was sentenced to 3 concurrent life sentences, but with a whole life stipulation. So he has no chance of parole. He was obviously psychologically assessed. And although he does obviously have a diagnosis of being psychopathic, etc., and psychotic, sorry, he knew what he was doing. He was very clearly choosing to do this.
Yeah.
It wasn't the insects in his brain saying whatever. And so he was sent to regular prison. But he was not happy. He wanted to be in Rampton Psychiatric Hospital.
Yeah.
So as I said, he did attempt suicide on a couple of occasions. He even went on hunger strike because he was trying to be moved to a psychiatric hospital. And he's still not doing too well. As in January of this year, another inmate stabbed him in the chest with a self-made wooden spear, just narrowly missing his heart.
Fuck.
So he's still alive, I think. He's obviously not getting on well with them. Like, people in prison are disgusted by him even. So
yeah, I think quite rightly.
So yeah, I was gonna say he wanted us to tell his story. I have. It's a little bit awkward.
Yeah, but it's not like episode one, is it?
Yeah,
it wasn't at the top of the list.
Yeah, you're like number 60 something on my list. Okay, deal with it. And that's only because we do UK as well. So if we were doing America, you'd be like way down there.
Yeah.
Done. Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.